Yesterday, it's different perspective allows you to start thinking about what the reasons would be to make the change. You know, and so then you hear a lot of things about, well, gee, maybe I should make this change, and here's how I might be able to do it, and here's some of the steps I need to take. What about for others when you were in the client role? What was your experience? Good outcomes. And fact, that is what the data show.
So our goals are to motivate healthy behavior change,
understand, resolve ambivalence,
and the other piece, and this is a direct development of motivation reviewing, is to create or amplify the discrepancy between the current behavior, which is sort of causing them problems, and what their larger goals are. So one aspect of motivation reviewing that we won't have time to get into today is working with the person's values and sort of helping them clarify what their values or their real hopes for their life are, as opposed to the way they're living now. And oftentimes those don't fit together. So if you get them to take a longer view and think about how they'd like their life to be in the future and whether or not the path they're on now is likely to get there, that's one way that we create and amplify discrepancy. And we're doing this by doing two things simultaneously. We express empathy. We're doing a lot of reflection, a lot of showing of understanding that we get their experience. And at the same time, we're raising doubt for the person. Raising their own doubt about, am I really where I want to be? And partly, we are making people a little uncomfortable with this approach. If they're okay with the status quo, then they're not uncomfortable and they're not motivated to change. So we want to raise some issues and raise some doubts, not at all in a confrontational way, but almost in a self-confrontational way. So if you think of reflective listening as a mirror, you're holding up a mirror to somebody so that they themselves can see and hear what they're saying and thinking. That's actually a very confrontational experience for somebody because they sort of realize, sometimes for the first time, what they really are saying and what their beliefs really are. And so it's sort of like encouraging self-confrontation as opposed to you being the heavy and saying you're living your life the wrong way and you're not getting where you want to get and you need to make a change. We want the person to be the one arguing for change. So the two principles we've talked about so far, express empathy, and then the second principle that I'm going to review right now, is sort of avoid argumentation or roll with resistance. Okay? Now, many people come into substance abuse treatment less than fully motivated, sometimes less than fully voluntary. Sometimes they come to you because someone sent them to you, not because they really are saying, hey, doc, I want to change, and can you help me? I never get those patients. So you've got to be prepped to sort of roll with the resistance. The motivational reviewing, we don't confront back. We don't hit it head on. We're going to sort of come alongside with the patient and join with them and understand their resistance, but not really engage it directly. I'm going to skip a couple of things here. One reason I like to see resistance is that I see it as energy. And when somebody is angry and frustrated about the way they came into you, so-and-so judge sent me to you, and I don't want to be here, and this is a waste of my time, and, I don't know if you ever hear that from your patients, but, that's some energy, and you can use that as momentum to sort of help them move forward. So, I might respond in a reflective way to that. So, you're not really happy about being here today. That's a simple reflection. Or, you're really not sure that this is going to be of any benefit to you at all. So there I'm just reflecting the resistance. I'm reflecting their frustration, And in fact, when you do that and you don't avoid it, oftentimes they're like, let me tell you all these other bad things that have happened to me. And before you know it, they're telling you their story and you're getting some understanding of them and they're starting to build trust in you. Other pieces of rolling with resistance is we're trying to get people to sort of slightly shift their perceptions. We're trying to get them to see things in a slightly different way. We're not trying to impose our worldview on them. We're trying to get them to reconsider some beliefs that maybe they've had for a long time that maybe aren't so productive for them. But it's really up to them if they're going to make a change in how they're looking at it. And we also believe that clients have lots of resources at their disposal, and it's a matter of us sort of helping them tap into that. So a solution they come up with is probably going to be better than any solution you can come up with or I can come up with in terms of you know, how are you going to make new friends? How are you going to stay away from your drug using friends? How are you going to get out of trouble? How are you going to get your rent money? You know, all of that. And there's at least two kinds of resistance that I see. One is the overt active type. You know, the person comes in obviously angry and frustrated, and they want to take it out on you, and you can see it real clearly. The other kind that's a little more difficult sometimes to deal with is the passive type, where, you know, maybe the person is just kind of quietly sitting there resentfully, not really giving you much, not really participating, maybe being a little passive-aggressive. That's also resistance in the viewpoint of this approach. And we want to sort of reflect it in a similar way. So yesterday when we saw the video of Bill Miller with the guy who was kind of not talkative at the beginning, Miller, instead of, you know, saying, hey, buddy, talk up, you know, you got to tell me what's going on, he said instead a reflection. You know, it's really hard for you to talk to someone about your problems. You know, you're used to handling things on your own. You know, so he reflected some of that passive resistance, and then as he went on, the guy started to open up a little bit. So if we don't roll with resistance, the alternative is confrontation, right? That we would confront back if we're being confronted. And what do we know about confrontation? Confrontation, the more confrontation that we observe in a session, the worse the outcomes in terms of substance use at a year later. So in this study, in a two-session intervention, the more confrontation, the more drinking at one-year follow-up. It was a very clear and strong correlation. And I'm not sure why this is, but it's something to pay attention to if any of you run women-only groups or groups for women's issues. So, I want to show you a little video clip now. Let's see what our time is like. Okay, we're in good shape. This is a video clip of a different therapist, Terry Moyers, who has worked with Bill Miller for years. She's an expert motivational interviewer. And this is somebody who was sort of mandated into treatment, who is not glad to be there at all, and who sort of starts out not only confrontational and hostile, but also sort of making personal attacks on the therapist, okay? And so what I want you to pay attention to is what does she do? Now, this guy is very entertaining. It's very seductive to get pulled into his story. But I really want you to try to focus on the therapist's behaviors. And to help you do that, you might even want to keep like a little tally sheet or something of ORs, you know, how many of the open questions do you count? How many reflections do you count? You don't have to do this. It's just optional. For me, it's helpful to try to, you know, classify what I'm hearing as I go. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play a few minutes of it, and then we'll stop and discuss it, and then I'll play a few more minutes so you can sort of see where it's going. Okay?
Well, Jim, I'm glad you're here. I'm kind of surprised to see you're coming back today.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I sat out in front here for about an hour before I came in. And I was about that close to just cranking that pickup up and heading back home. I'll let you know, just like I told Rich, I'm not real happy about being here. I hope you understand that.
I'm hearing you loud and clear that being here is not something that's really a high priority for you.
And I'm looking at you and you got blonde hair. You know, I haven't had a lot of luck with blonde hair the last couple of weeks.
Is that right? Well, tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, I got assigned a probation officer, and she's a blonde haired gal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's out to just destroy me totally. You know, she's talking about me getting a lot of jail time and this big fine and everything that she's going to do if I don't do certain things. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of think maybe you're going to do the same thing to me.
So it seems to you like I might try to push you around and make you do a whole bunch of things you don't want to do.
Yeah, I'm about up to here with this kind of stuff. I hope you know that probably isn't your fault, but that's just kind of the way things been going.
You're pretty fed up.
Yeah, my daughter, you know, she, won't let me see the kids.
Your grandchildren. What's that about?
Well, she'll let me see them, but she won't let me take them anywhere anymore.
Really?
And that really has me upset, you know. She's afraid that I'll take them, hurt them, drive around, drinking and driving, things like that. And I never have hurt one of them kids.
So she's afraid that if you take the children with you, that you'll be drinking and then you might hurt them again.
You know, when I say that, but I wouldn't drink, she still won't trust me. And that's really got me upset, really got me ticked off.
So the fact that your daughter won't even take your word for the fact that you won't drink kind of bites at you a little bit.
And she said, you know, well, you need help. Well, you know, when she needed help, I damn sure didn't put any kind of condition on, you know. And I don't know what else she means I need help. You know, I've always bailed her out. I've always helped her financially. She needs kids to watch. Mm-hmm. Anything she needs, old daddy's always giving it to her. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where she's getting all this from. This is really...
What does she say to you about her concerns?
Well, she says she's afraid that, you know, I'll do something that hurt the kids.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I never hurt the kids. I mean, never had in my life. Is it
kind of a mystery to you why she'd even be worried about that?
Ever since my wife moved out, I think she's just taken an attitude with my wife, you know, that she's siding with her for some reason. Mm-hmm. You know, up until my wife moved out, things are going pretty good. You know, we're not divorced, but my wife is kind of upset at me also. She moved out a couple, 3 months ago.
Do you kind of have the feeling that your wife and daughter are ganging up against you?
It feels that way. I don't know if that's true, but I just kind of feel like, well, what do they call it? One thing gets you down, everybody jumps on. That's what I feel now, you know, that since that DWI, the car wreck and everything, and my wife's left, my daughter's, you know, raising Cain with me. Now my probation officer's wanting to eat my lunch, put me in jail, and, you know, break me financially and things like that. My boss has all but said if I lose my driver's license, I won't have a job there. I've got about 3 more years to go before I retire. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what I'm doing here, you know, or why I'm coming here, the only reason I'm coming here is so that I can maybe save my driver's license. I won't lose my job, so I won't lose my house. Mm-hmm. It's not because I won't do any of this crap.
Yeah. You're not here because you think you have a problem. You're here because they sent you here.
Yeah, the court sent me here.
Mm-hmm. And that's the only reason you're here.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. There's no need for me lying to you because, you know, unless you go down and tell the court that, you know, I'm not motivated to be here or anything. But I don't like any of this. I'll be honest with you. You know, it's taken a lot of time that I don't have. It's taken a lot of money that I don't have, you know, for the court and the fines and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. On top of that, I've got to pay my lawyer $1,000, which I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
To represent me, and I guess he's probably one of the reasons I'm here today, because, but you know, he...
All right, let me stop there. So a lot is going on in this first few minutes, okay? What do you observe Terry Moyers, the therapist, doing? So she's reflecting a lot of that emotional tone that he's given her. You know, that negative, I don't want to be here, I feel ganged up on, I feel, you know. In her reflections, she's using words like that to try to show him that she understands his frustration. Okay? What else is happening? What is...
She's allowing him to be.
So some allowing him just to vent, okay? And what is she not doing? Like, there's a lot that she's restraining here.
Not criticizing,
not confronting. Sort of accepting in a neutral, non-judgmental way the content that he's giving her. What about when he starts saying, you know, you got blonde hair, and I haven't had much luck with blondes, and that's kind of a personal thing, a comment that he makes about her. What does she do with that? She rolled with it, and all she said is, oh, really? Tell me more about that. You know, so she sort of acknowledged it and then followed it with an open question. Okay? Just imagine if somebody came in your office and picked on some personal characteristic that you have and said, you know, well, I haven't had much luck with so-and-so's, something like you, you know. That might be a little hard to just be calm about. And so she does a really great job of being neutral, non-judgmental, calm, you know, eliciting from him his story, letting him tell his story, and just putting enough structure so that it's moving along.
Matter of fact and strong.
Yes, her reflections are very brief. She might give a little bit of an analogy here and there, and we'll see it one in a minute. But she's simple, a simple communicator. She's using some simple language, and just right there. Another thing that she has not done is she's not delving deep into any one area yet. So he's already thrown out a bunch of gems that might be interested to follow up on. All right, since a DWI contract, my wife moved out, my dog got run over by a train. I mean, he's essentially listing all the bad stuff that's happened. And, you know, also he's shown a little emotion about, you know, his daughter won't let him see his grandchildren. And in other approaches, you might be tempted to go for the emotion, go deeper, follow those up. He's got a lot of losses and that kind of stuff, you know. And yet in motivational interviewing, we tend to have more of a surface view of those kinds of things when we're getting to know someone. And what we call it is the bird's eye view. Okay, initially we want to get a sense of all the different things that are bubbling up in the person's life without delving very deep into any one. And so she's letting a lot of that stuff pass. Not that she's not hearing it or not noticing it, but she's not derailing the momentum by diving into any one thing yet. So that's another way in which she's kind of restrained, or maybe this technique's a little different than some other ways that you might go. Any other comments or questions about that?
I'm sorry, the fact that the patient's saying, I have a problem, either of you, so
yes.
You can't push back and bring it to it.
I don't have a problem, I just need a note.
Right.
You know? I need a note for the judge, so I keep my job, so I keep my house, so I can retire. Yeah. You know, so he's being very frank in some ways. I mean, a lot of times patients won't admit that much to you right away. But, you know, so what do you do with that? So far she's just like, oh, okay, tell me more about it.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Let's go a little further with this. Oh, the other thing I wanted to comment on is that so far, you know, he's very agitated, upset, you know, kind of thrown out these personal things towards her, and yet already, this is only a few minutes in, you're starting to see his emotional tone calm down a little bit. So part of what's happening is that nice, neutral, non-judgmental approach she has with simple, reflective listening is helping him to tone it down a little bit.
Been together. Mm-hmm. I've known this guy since he was got out of law school.
Yeah.
And he's a good friend of mine, but I said, well, why do I have to go up here? I'm paying you $1,000 to represent me, and now I got to go over and go through this evaluation and all that. That does not make sense. And he's fired. You've got a drinking problem. Hell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to take him home a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
That I've been the one standing. He's been passed out and couldn't walk. It doesn't make sense. None of this makes sense.
So it's confusing to you why your drinking should cause a problem or everybody should be talking about that when you look around and you see that other people drink more than you do.
Well, at this point in my life, it'd be different now. I mean, 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I probably would have taken my medicine without being too cranky about it.
Mm-hmm.
But let me tell you something. I've changed an awful lot in 10 years. I used to be a rounder. I used to fight. I used to rodeo. I used to drink a lot. I made a living hauling rodeo stock and everything. And now I've settled down the last, you know, 8, 10 years. I got a good job. I'm driving short distance hauls. Mm-hmm. I drink a little bit, but I work hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's nothing for me to sit down and drink six pack or two of beer and still be able to function. I'm not like one of them bums you see laying down there by the bus depot on the lawn selling his blood and stealing the hubcaps.
Mm-hmm.
I never stole anything, and I've worked every day since I got a Social Security card.
So it's kind of the same thing you were saying before, which is that it feels like everybody's looking at your drinking, but it's just not as bad as everybody thinks it is.
You might say that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's true, but you might say that.
Since you've been forced to come here, and since you're feeling like everybody's kind of pecking on you like a crow, there's a bunch of crows flying around pecking on you about this thing about your drinking, what would you like to do with the time that you spend with me here? What would be helpful for you?
I don't know, because I ain't never been in one of these situations.
This is all new for you.
And people keep saying you need to stop drinking. I ain't never done that either.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think I could. Mm-hmm. I've tried a couple times, and I wasn't very... One time I quit for a week or two,
mm-hmm.
just to show people I could stop drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't too happy. And I really, I didn't know why the hell I stopped anyway, but...
It almost sounds like you don't know whether you could stop, even if you wanted to.
That's a funny thing to say. I can do just about anything, but I can't say yes to that, you know, that I can stop. Mm-hmm.
So you, it's
a lot of things I can do, but, you know, I've never tried to stop drinking. I keep thinking about it, honestly.
Okay. What are the kinds of things you think would keep you from being able to stop? What would get in your way?
I got some buddies. They're pretty,
mm-hmm.
pretty much like me. I'm not the leader of the pack, but none of them boss me around. We all go down to the lake on the weekends. We got a spot out there, we call it the bunker, and we all take our boats down there and we all meet over on the east side of Elephant Butte Lake there. And we've kind of cleaned it all up, made a campsite out of it. And, you know, we get down there and hoot and holler, shoot guns, and have fishing contests, and do a wrestle around once in a while. We toss somebody in the lake, things like that.
Sounds like you guys have a good time.
Yeah, I don't know how they'd feel about me quit drinking. I don't know what they'd call me.
So they might have some names for you, or they might, you know, say things about you.
Yeah, the first thing they say, well, I probably couldn't hold my liquor, and that's why I stopped. I didn't drink. I ain't out drinking any of them.
What would that be like for you if you didn't drink and you were around them?
What do you do for a living?
Well, you know, I'm a psychologist.
Yeah, well, what would you do if you couldn't be a psychologist?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what it's like for you. You can't even imagine.
You couldn't give me an answer, and I can't give you one. So that's just kind of, that's a hard thing. Maybe that's something that I need to think about before I even do any of this stuff, you know, that you're talking, or they're talking about.
What else do you think might get in your way besides this thing with your friends and maybe not having things as easy socially as they were?
Well, I'm kind of that type of guy. I have a part job. I work around a lot of old boys that are pretty rough and tumble.
Mm-hmm.
I drive long ways and I unload big trucks and I get tired. Sometimes I like to sit down and have a drink.
So drinking kind of helps you relax and you know, cope with your life.
When I get really angry, I don't have to go slap somebody around. I used to, man. When I was younger, I'd go over to somebody that upset me or irritated me, I'd take it to them. But since I've gotten older, I kind of, you know, three or four beers, I kind of cooled down a little bit.
You know, you've mentioned that twice already, that you used to be more hot-tempered than you are right now. What do you think caused you to kind of become less angry and less violent?
I got put in jail a few times. It was one of them. You know, I used to go down and hang out in some pretty rough places, and I got thrown in jail a couple of times. Disorderly conduct and public brawling and things like that. My wife had to come bail me out several times. It got pretty costly doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of, even though I enjoyed it, it was kind of, it got a little bit costly, and I got a bad name in town, things like that. You know, people, I'm from a little, small little town, like 20 mile north of here. And everybody knows me, and they kind of, especially the policemen, they know me pretty good, so they don't cut me no slack anymore.
So it looks like that was causing you problems in a lot of different areas, with the law and your family and other people in town.
Well, just like this thing, my DWI. Did Rich tell you about what happened to me?
Yeah, he did.
And I was sitting there at the damn stop sign. Well, first of all, what happened was Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all going to Lake Adam. I had my boat hooked up to my pickup. Then my job called me and said they want me to come out there and just drive one load out to Hamer Springs and back. And then I'd be off for the rest of the day. Well, I'd already had three or four beers, maybe more. We had partied last night before, and I got up and I was kind of feeling bad. So I had three or four drinks early that morning, but I was just going to the lake. I wasn't going to work, and it was my Saturday off, and they called me. And I went ahead and I was on my way out to the job, sitting at that four-way stop sign, and this old woman, she must have been 100 years old, come flying down the road and crashed right into the back end of that pickup of mine. And the police come, and them said they didn't arrest me. And they said it was my fault for being there. Now, that didn't make sense. You know, some kids or a school bus been sitting there, that woman had wiped them all out. She's lucky she hit my truck. And it didn't tear it up too bad, but it bent it pretty good. But.
So just because you were drinking, they kind of used that as an excuse to pin the accident on you.
On me. She walks away, scot-free, tore my pickup up, and I got to pay for her car. Or fixing her car and then my pickup, and then I'm the one that had to pay all the penalty because somebody's grandma got out there, couldn't see, driving around crazy. You know, it's really weird. Mm-hmm. He's stupid. That's got me upset too.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Time I think about that too.
Yeah. And this accident is what caused you to have to come in here and got you in all that trouble at work, and now they're thinking about taking your driver's license away, and that's why you got to come here.
Yeah. Is there anything you guys can do maybe about me keeping my license and all that? You know, could you say something to my that witch I got for a probation officer, maybe get her off my back? Or is there, you know, I wouldn't mind doing some of this stuff if there was anything in it for me, but so far I'm going to pay this and pay the lawyer and pay for the wreck and pay for the evaluation and everything, and so far old Jim ain't got nothing.
Okay. Well, let me just say that I think here in the treatment center, we try not to get too involved with the legal aspects or the legal trouble. But lots of times people who have a DWI come here and they stay in treatment for a while and they quit drinking. And then usually if that happens, they're kind of out of trouble with the DWI and with the probation officer. But, you know, I don't know whether that's something that you're interested in at this point or not.
This treatment center thing, is that here at this facility?
Yeah.
And what do y'all do?
We do all different kinds of things. We have all different kinds of treatments here. Some people come here and live for a while. Some people come on an outpatient basis. Some people come with their families. Some people come by themselves. And there's just all different kinds of ways to do it. There's definitely more than one right way.
You said people come here to live. Do you think I'd have to come here to live?
Well, I think, you know, you're the one that really needs to make that decision about what's the right kind of treatment for you. I couldn't decide that for you.
I wouldn't mind coming here to live, but I wouldn't want to be in one of them places where you sit around in pajamas, a bunch of long-haired hippie types crying and bitching and stuff like that. That ain't my style.
So you're kind of wondering what it would even be like here.
Well, I've seen pictures of things, you know, watch TV and some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. How long do you think I'd be here?
Well, again, I think that's something that you need to decide what kind of treatment you want. I mean, there's some guidelines, but on the other hand, you would need to be the one that decided.
I don't want something to happen in court.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guarantee it happened in court? Or?
Well, I surely can't guarantee it. All I can say is that people who have been here in the past, you know, we have been able to help them with that.
You know, there's another thing I was thinking about. You know, if I don't stop drinking, I'm probably going to be right back in this mess again.
Yeah.
So not right away, but somewhere down the road.
It sounds like if you look ahead, take a look at your drinking and see where you're going to go with that, you're kind of worried about that.
Yeah, because if I get out of this, if I can save my house and my job, I better do something that's going to keep me from doing this again, don't you think?
It's time for you to really get serious about this.
Yeah. I did something about the fight thing. I just didn't go to bars no more.
Right. You were successful in changing that in the past, and you seem like you'd kind of like to be successful changing this.
Right, but as long as I'm putting all this money in, I'd like to come out with something.
Like to get something for your money, huh?
Yeah. That makes sense, though.
Yeah, it sure does.
But boy, I tell you what, I'm sure not really looking forward to any of this, I don't know.
So you kind of feel two ways about it, you know? On one hand, you think you'd like to have the change, and you'd like to quit drinking, and on the other hand, you think you kind of dread it.
Is that normal?
Yeah, that's real normal for people when they first start thinking about something like this.
Okay. What did you see in that part? What are some of the main things that were happening?
She looked
it. Say what?
She looked it. I think she got
she
it.
She looked it.
Yeah.
Okay. And how did she do that?
I think by staying calm, using reflective, thank you, Mr. Kim. Letting him tell his story, not interrupting, not being critical of him, just accepting him where he is.
Right, right. And some of the ways she did reflections were around these areas of resistance and around these areas of, what he feels like people are picking on him and being unfair to him. And one of the things that we do in motivational interviewing is we emphasize personal choice and control. And so you heard her saying several times, well, there's some guidelines, but it would have to be up to you. Well, I could dictate to you what kind of treatment, that would be up to you. Whether you're interested in treatment, I don't even know. That would be up to you. And she also emphasized things like, when people come into the treatment center and they quit drinking, sometimes they're out of trouble. But I don't know if that's something that you're interested in. So many times she kind of throws the responsibility and choice back to him instead of at all taking a controlling stance where she would imply that they would be trying to control him or forcing his hand in any way. And because he's kind of a feisty guy, if you fight with him, he's going to fight back, right? And so he even throws out these kind of, inflammatory statements, but then what she does with it is sort of very neutrally and calmly reflects back, and then beyond just the reflection, she gives lots of those statements emphasizing that he's in charge. He's in control of his own choices, which is nothing less than the truth. No matter how much we would love for our patients to leave our office and make change, it's really up to them. There's nothing we can do to force them to make a change. Even if we think it would be healthier for them, they have to choose it. And so by saying the truth, that it's up to them to make a change, sometimes you're able to hook them in and get them a little more interested. She did a couple of other things. Her specific way of doing reflections, okay? Yesterday we talked about reflections as kind of paraphrasing and showing understanding of what's going on in the session and what you've heard so far. But there were two specific kinds that she used that are a little more advanced. One of them is called an amplified reflection. And that is where you reflect a part of what the person said, and you actually ramp it up a little bit around the resistance. So she said, the only reason you're here is because they sent you. You're not here because you think you have a problem. You're here only because they sent you. And so what she's doing is she's reflecting what she heard, but by saying that only, that's the only reason he's here, it sort of invites the person to back away a little bit from their stance I'm so mad. Most of the time when you do that, people will say, well, maybe that's not the only reason. And in fact, he said, well, if I could get anything out of it, I might be interested. But so far, old Jim ain't got nothing, And so that then let her say, well, what would you like to get out of it? How could we be helpful to you? What might you be interested in? And then he comes up with all these, concerns about what would be like, and it's going to be a bunch of hippies crying, can I fit in here? And so, you can see he's already thinking about entering treatment. When at the beginning of this 16-minute segment, he was saying he was going to crank up his truck and drive away. Okay, so she's gotten him to kind of come a long way with the use of a few relatively simple techniques, the reflective listening, open questions, amplified reflection, emphasizing personal choice and control. The other thing she did at the very end there is called a double-sided reflection, and this goes right to the heart of the ambivalence we've been discussing. So she says, on the one hand, you'd like to have a change, and on the other hand, you kind of dread it. And that's when he said, he really thinks she gets him now. And then he says, is that normal? And she says, yeah, that's real normal for somebody just lot that's happened in this short amount of time with the use of these techniques. Now, sometimes when I'm working with people trying to learn motivational interviewing, they feel like, oh, well, if I do all this open questioning, if I do all this reflection, you know, am I not going to get bogged down? Is this, the session's going to be 5 hours long? And, you know, people are just going to talk so much that I'm not going to be able to sort of shut it down. But in fact, what really happens once you get skillful at this is the opposite. You know, oftentimes when I'm doing motivational interviewing, I might have a 45-minute session, but really by about 20 minutes, I've gotten to the heart of the matter, and the person is now actively thinking about, do I want to make a change? And so it actually can make your interventions briefer and more effective. And I think that's why the literature shows that motivational interviewing, 1 to 4 sessions, is essentially equivalent to 12 or more sessions of other kinds of treatment. And I think it's because we're getting right to the heart of the matter pretty quickly, we're getting into people's experience pretty quickly, and it's targeting their own motivation and readiness for change rather than, you know, us trying to do something to them or draw something out of them that's not relevant. Any other comments about this video example? Any of you have patients like this guy? Kind of rambunctious and, you know, argumentative? Yeah, they're kind of fun to work with. All right, so let's see. We have about 20 minutes left. Is that right? I think we ended at 11:30. So actually, we have a little longer. Okay, perfect.
Could you give us Iglesias' quote when he's making a statement that's real, authentic to himself? And she, when she was kind of like, eh, do this hand motion. Did you notice that?
You're more observant than I am. What do you think that means? Develop discrepancy means a couple of things. We want the person to have a sense that how they want things to be is different than the way they are now. And so if you remember the term cognitive dissonance, if you took psychology 101 or social psychology back in the day, you'll remember that cognitive dissonance is this uncomfortable feeling that somebody gets when they're trying to hold two conflicting opinions at the same time. Okay? And social psychology studies have shown that people will work pretty hard to get rid of that cognitive dissonance. So, for example, there were some very famous studies where they took college students who had very strong either liberal or conservative points of view, and they assigned them to debate the opposite side. And so what happened is rather than retaining their rigid points of view, their points of view actually shifted in favor of the things that they were being asked to speak for. And so the fact that they were being asked to sort of be a proponent of the other side, of the other arguments, actually made them move their opinions because it was intolerable for them to be espousing one point of view while holding another. The other implication of that is that if you can get people to verbally commit or verbally talk about making certain changes, they're actually more likely to do them. Now, that doesn't mean we force the person to talk about it. That means if you can spontaneously get them to do it. In those studies with college students, this was a research design. But clinically, we know that if people start talking in one direction, there is a momentum that builds in that direction. So a couple of other things about discrepancy. It is sort of the difference between where you are and where you want to be. And one way to raise an awareness of that is to have a discussion with the patient about the consequences that they've had of their current And this is not done in, you know, a confrontational, negative way. This is more done by eliciting from them, what are your concerns about your drinking? What are your concerns about your drug use? You know, what are the things that bother you about it? You know, sort of putting in these simple words, eliciting from them what their own fears, concerns, worries, plans are about that. And pretty quickly, you can usually develop a list of a bunch of negative consequences, and then you have the opportunity to use your reflection skills and summarize what you've heard. So it sounds like what you're saying is, let me use an example of the guy we just saw. Okay, if you were to do a summary with him, you might say something like, well, I know we're just getting started, but so far, what I'm hearing you saying is that your drinking has created some problems for you. And some of those problems are in your personal life, where your wife has left and your daughter is not letting you see your children, your grandchildren, and you know, you feel like that relationship is disrupted. Some of them are in the area of your work, where you're threatened to lose your job if you lose your license. Some of these consequences or things that have happened because of your drinking are legal problems. They're causing you financial problems and stress, and you've got to go through a lot of turmoil to try to resolve those things. And I also heard you say that there's a part of you that wonders if maybe you shouldn't consider making a change now, because if you don't, you might end up back here again. Even if you got out of trouble now, it might happen again. And so there's a part of you that wonders if you, you know, might should make a change now. That would be a summary that I might do with the goal of sort of increasing the sense of discrepancy. You know, that gee, I have a lot of consequences going on. And when you list them that way, they really start adding up in your mind. And yet, I'm not like hammering him with it. I'm not bashing him with it or confronting him or saying, you're in denial, here's all these bad things that you're doing. I'm just saying, you know, here's what I'm hearing. You know, do I have that right? And after you do a summary like that, an important thing to do is to ask a key question such as, what do you make of all this? Where does this lead you now? What's the next step? These are open questions that have sort of momentum built in. That's why they're called key questions in motivational interviewing. Questions that sort of, you know, the only way they can answer that question is to tell you what they're going to do next, or to give you what their view is of what the problem is. I'm going to skip a couple of these. They'll be in your handouts when I email them to you, so you can read that at your leisure. But the goal of building discrepancy is to elicit change talk, okay? We have this little acronym in motivational interviewing, the DARN C. And so what we want is we want people ultimately to make a commitment to change, because we know that if people verbalize a commitment to change, a year later, 2 years later, they're much more likely to have made that change. So how do we get there? Well, the D-A-R-N, let me describe what those are. D is desire. Do you have a desire to change? What does that desire sound like? Something like, I really want to make a change. You know, that's a very simple statement of desire. Now, I really want things to be different. That's a statement of desire. Okay? That's one form of sort of pre-commitment, change talk. A stands for ability. I think if I wanted to make a change, I probably could. I think if I came into treatment, I could stop drinking. Other statements of ability might even be stronger. You know I can do it if I make a commitment to it. You know, he said on the tape, you know, he was previously fighting with people. And he changed that because he enjoyed it, but it was too costly for him. So, you know, that was the thing that tipped the decisional balance for him with the fighting. He decided just not to go to the bars anymore. And so he stopped fighting. He stopped putting himself in the position. And so she emphasizes that former success. You're successful in changing that, and you'd like to have that with this problem also. So ability. R stands for reasons. people will give you 100 reasons why they might want to change, and it doesn't really matter if those reasons are not the ones you think they should be. Research shows that if people verbalize any of these things, desire, ability, reasons, and N is need, any of them, it's related to subsequent commitment talk. So any of these pieces of change talk. So it might even be, I need to stop because I don't want to go back to jail. I don't want to quit, but I need to. That's just as good of a motivation. That's just as good of a piece of change talk as a strongly felt desire. Okay. So don't think that you have to have all of these to be moving towards commitment. In fact, sometimes it's just a good one that'll get them there. So the research shows that when people were receiving motivational interviewing counseling and spoke these kinds of pieces of language, the desirability, reasons, and need, by the middle of the session, then what happened is if there's an increasing slope of that change talk, if they're having more and more of that talk by the end of the session, outcome tended to be good. If it goes in the opposite direction, if they come in and they're considering change, but by the end of the session, they're talking about not changing, then you know the outcome actually isn't so good. So what you want to hear and listen for on your tapes, or if you're supervising your junior colleagues' tapes, do you hear this change talk, and do you hear more and more of it as the session goes on? If so, that's a really good sign.